The Asian Classics Institute presents Applied Meditation with Geshe Michael Roach, recorded live in New York City in February of 1994. This is the beginning of Class 1.
The logical proofs for emptiness and things like that. And they were difficult. And they were sort of mentally very difficult. And people did well, but they were very, it was a difficult course. And people were saying, how about something a little bit more practice-y? So we're gonna do meditation, how to meditate. And this will come from the classical sources. The first book we use will be, it's called the Prayer of Samantabhadra, and I'll spell it for you. This prayer in the Kangyur and in the Tengyur, it's actually in both, and it's so it comes from very early Buddhism, 9500 BC. And this prayer is in 9500 BC. And this prayer is the basis for all later presentations of how to prepare for a meditation session. Not how to meditate, but how to get ready for a meditation session. What you have to do before a meditation session for it to be successful. And that's the first major subject that we'll study, which is the how to prepare for a meditation session. There are certain things you have to do before you sit down that make your meditation much more successful. If you don't do them, it's very difficult to have a good meditation session. And this is taught by the Buddha. This is 500 BC. So those, we're going to go through those, the prayer of Samantabhadra. And in that prayer, he presents the preliminaries, what you have to do before a meditation session. We're going to do that according to Tsongkhapa. Tsongkhapa wrote a commentary to it. I think Tsongkhapa is, I have to check it. He was a Kagyu. He studied with the great Sakya teacher in Bala. And he's a Nyingma also. And later, Gelugpas came from him. But he wasn't a Gelugpa in that sense. He was the first. But he wasn't a Gelugpa in that sense. He was the first. So, His most famous students are three, the first Dalai Lama. Gyaltsev Jain, Kirtan, you don't have to know that, but one day, these are all Gyaltsev Jain's works. These are Gyaltsev Jain's works. These are Kirtan Jain's works. And in the middle are Tsongkhapa's works. Tsongkhapa's about 10,000 pages, and his two students are about 8,000 pages. It's incredible. You could never study them in a lifetime, but they wrote them. And they're very deep. Very difficult to get through. We spent in the monastery maybe 5 years doing half of one of them. Very deep, very wonderful. So we're going to study this prayer written 500 BC on the basis of his commentary. And that commentary is found in the Lamrim Chenmu. The most famous book ever written. It's the most famous book ever written in Tibetan, period. It's 1,000 pages long. Lam Rim means, Rim means stages, Lam of the path. Rim means stages, Lam of the path. And Chemo means big. Lam means path, Rim means stages, or steps. Chenmo means big. Mo is a feminine ending. The great holy books of Tibet have feminine endings. Okay. Wisdom is feminine. So this is the Mo is the female ending.
Sorry,
Chen means big, and Mo is actually the feminine ending. And that's his presentation of all the steps you have to do to become a Buddha. And it starts at the very baby steps, and it goes up to the highest levels of Tantra, all in one book. There is no other book that has all of those in it. He collated the great books of India. In the monastery, we studied five great texts of Indian Buddhism that were written from 200 AD up to about 1100 AD. But this book includes all of it in one book. So we're going to take our study of how to prepare for meditation session from that, and that's part of the reading you had in the back of your notebook. So we'll study that from the Lamrim Chenmu. So if I were to ask you to name like the five major parts of meditation, the first one would be getting ready, preparing for meditation. The second, and by the way, that has two parts. There's what we call the six preliminaries, which is on your syllabus. And there's something we call the seven ingredients. It's also called the seven limb practice. And those two are what you need to get ready for a meditation session. There are six activities that you do before the meditation. And part of one of them involves seven steps. So that's how you're going to get ready for a meditation session. You have to do those to have a successful meditation. You can't just pop down and meditate. You have to gear yourself up. These are the things that get your mind, they disengage your mind from your office and get your mind to meditation. There still has to be some gap there where you change gears. And these function to do that. The second part of the practice of the study of meditation will be the physical, a study of the physical circumstances you need, the physical environment you need to step to do a successful meditation, and that's called the six conditions. We'll cover that in the second class, the second week. I'm sorry. So far you have two steps. One is preparing for meditation, and one is the physical circumstances you need for meditation. A third will be the posture, the bodily posture you need for meditation, and that's called the eight-part posture. It has eight steps. How to put your body into meditation, how to get your body in the right physical the right physical posture. That'll be the second half of the second week. That will also come from the Lama Nchimo. And Lama Nchimo is basically just a big patchwork of earlier works. It isn't considered in Buddhism a big deal to write your own book. It's considered very proper to plagiarize everybody else who came before, because they're omniscient. So how can you improve on it? You can change around the order for present-day people of your day, but you don't need to write anything new. They knew everything, literally. So why? It's not a virtue to add to it or subtract from it. So he's basing his presentation on Kamala Shila, who lived in the 9th century. And he wrote a huge book on meditation. It's called Gomu. Kamala Shila. You don't have to know that, but if you're curious. Kamala Shila lived in the 9th century. He's famous for, he was one of the Indian masters who came to Tibet. And when he got to Tibet, and then a Chinese master reached Tibet at the same time. His name was Huashang. And the Chinese master was teaching that meditation consisted of emptying your mind and thinking about nothing at all. And Kamala Shila was teaching that the opposite. He said meditation is an instrument or a tool, a microscope for focusing the mind, and then you must have a meaningful object. It's not that you just try to empty your mind. We'll get into that. There are results of that meditation, and that is a specific non-Buddhist meditation, and it leads to certain apparently desirable results, but we'll talk about why it's not very desirable. So they had a debate. The way you settled a philosophical or a religious debate in the old days, and that's when debating was serious. I mean, you would have a contest in public, and other masters and the king of the country would attend. And whoever was, after like 2 or 3 weeks of public debate each day, the king and his board of advisors would select the winner. And if you lost, you had to join the school of the winner. And all your followers had to change religions. So it was very serious. And Kamala Shila won. And it's called Huashang Dawa. The viewpoint that you should meditate on nothing was expelled from Tibet. That teaching was not allowed in Tibet. They had one other famous debate of the same kind about which monk's system, which monk's vows system should they follow. There were different systems of denial. And the school that went out was a certain Savastivada, which is now prevalent in Thailand and other countries. So we followed the same rules. That's the custom that was prescribed for Tibet. And that's the oldest system of So, in meditation we follow Mahayana. As far as our monk's system, we are pure Hinayana. Our vows and everything are pure Hinayana. So that's Kamala Shila.
Was it part of Huashang's
belief
or doctrine that instant illumination that...
I don't know. I have not heard that. I haven't heard that he believed in Satori or something like that. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. I
haven't heard that. I don't know at all.
That wasn't part of that whole debate?
I haven't seen it. There are Western scholars who believe the debate went into place.
But we say it did. And it's always quoted. But I could check it for you in the computer. Literally.
It says something great.
Yeah, no, I can see if in 30,000 pages it's mentioned. I doubt it. But I can check. So that would be, what are we on now? The first was preparing. The second was the place, you know, the physical place where you're supposed to meditate. Third was how you arrange your body, how you get your body ready. And then you can guess what the fourth one is. How you get your mind, you know, what you actually meditate on. And in there we're going to have three steps. The first step is called the five problems of meditation. These are five typical mental states that come up in your mind while you're trying to meditate. And you have to learn to identify them. They are the classic tricks that your mind plays on you when you're trying to meditate.
five.
They're like the five, we call them the five problems of meditation. There are five, you know, since 2,500 years ago, people who meditated had the same five problems come up. They come up in a certain order. They're very predictable. People have spent their lives studying this, meditating, and they have made this list. And these are the five typical problems that you get while you're trying to meditate. Then there are what we call the eight corrections. And these are eight different actions that you take to stop the five problems, to block the five problems. So it's very useful. What you're doing is you're like reading the car repair manual before you try to fix the car. It's very good. It's very useful. And while you're meditating, the problem comes, and you already know what you're supposed to do. So that's very useful. So that's, again, part of the mental states. Then there are nine mental states that result. There are nine stages you go through as you improve, as your meditation gets better. Fighting is still part of the mental process, which is number four, right?
Yeah.
It's still part of the mental process. Meaning, you get five problems coming up, you use eight different methods to stop them, and during that struggle, you're going through nine deeper stages of meditation. The ninth stage is the deepest stage. The first stage is where it's called, if you drew a picture of your meditation, you would be like this. Distracted, 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 distracted. One little block of concentration. No, seriously, it's called Lambatam. Then you get. And then later on, one of the later stages, it's more like this, you know. And the concentrated periods get, you know, 30 seconds long, 1 minute long. We're talking real concentration, you know. And it's literally that bad at the beginning. You're lucky to have a few, maybe 30 seconds or a minute of pure concentration. And then your mind wanders, and then you come back to it. So we're going to go through this process. So you'll be able to identify where you are mentally as you meditate, you know, as you get better at it. To get better at it, you must do it every day. It's exactly like exercise. And we'll talk about it. But it's not something you can ever get or ever will get if you don't do a little bit daily. And it doesn't mean like an hour. It means like 20 minutes or a half hour of good meditation. Otherwise, you'll never get it. If you don't get it, you will never see emptiness. Impossible. You cannot progress through the five paths if you're not in a deep state of meditation. It's impossible. Progression through the five paths, going from one path to the other, always takes place during meditation. So if you're not meditating regularly, it's impossible. You will never. So you really do have to do it. And I have to do it. I haven't been doing it for a while. So that's part of my game plan. I would like to start again, too. I was good for many years. And then I got lazy. So I'm almost thinking about it. It's kind of an excuse for me to start this. So you really have to. Meditation is a thing that if you're not doing it regularly, you can miss a day a week or something. But if you're not doing it like that, it's like weightlifting or something. You'll never do it. You'll never get the results out of it. And you can't see emptiness unless you're on a very high level. It's impossible. So it's really very necessary. We'll talk more about it. Nine resulting states that you get. Okay, by applying the how many antidotes corrections?
Eight.
To how many problems?
Five.
Okay, that's all right. Then the last part of the course, in the last 2 weeks, we'll be discussing the object of meditation. I think it's important to say meditation is only a tool. Meditation is not by itself an end. It has no benefit, religiously, spiritually, by itself. It has to be focused on a meaningful outcome. By itself, it has temporary side effects that make you calm or something, but they have no meaning spiritually. They will not remove your suffering. They will not advance you in any way, meaningfully. It has to be focused on something very meaningful. So the last 2 weeks we'll cover meaningful objects for meditation. So we'll discuss the object of meditation. What are you going to aim this powerful tool at? Because if it's just a powerful tool that you're not aiming at anything, it's useless. It has no benefit. So you've got five steps. I'll pick on people. Robin, first one?
Preparation.
Yeah. Faith, second one?
Study of the physical environment.
Yeah, you know, what should the place be like where you're going to meet a friend?
The third one is the body position.
Yeah, how is your body going to be when you get into meditation? Janet, fourth one? Diamond.
What you actually meditating
on. No. Fourth one was the mental state. Okay? See, the first three are the first is preparation. The second is the place. I'm sorry, did I say
what to meditate on?
You said. Yeah, we have it.
For four?
Yeah.
Four, yes.
Just the mental state.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. I'll go over that again. First is the preliminary, the preparation. What do you do before you go into your meditation? Secondly is the environment, right? Third is the physical posture. How do you sit? Fourth is the mental states that are going on. The mental, what do you call it?
Process.
One is the physical. Number three is the physical postures. And then number four is the mind states you go through.
Mental activity.
Is technique included in there?
You could say it's the mental technique, yeah. It's the problems that come up, how you stop them, and what stages will you go through if you're able to do this process well. And that's all the mental part of meditation. The mental aspect of meditation. What's going on in your mind in the meditation. And then number five is, what are you going to aim this meditation at? What are you going to think about? You know, I've said it before, I mean, it's incredible. The ability to concentrate is incredible. But the object is not meaningful. So he has, by the way, a non-Buddhist can attain perfect meditation, according to Buddhist theory. And they do. You know, great Hindu practitioners in India have, they've got perfect concentration. They have, as a result, they have clairvoyance. They can see the future or whatever. But ultimately, the object is not something that will remove their suffering. But we say that a non-Buddhist can attain a high state of meditation. Because it's only a tool. It's only a focusing of the mind. Which brings me to the next subject. Tibetan Buddhism and Sanskrit Buddhism, and Buddhism in general, has a lot of words for meditation. And I thought I would go through a short list of them. This is on your homework, okay? Because you're going to hear lots of different kinds of words. The words in English are not finalized yet. And you're going to read books about Buddhism, and they're going to have all meditative equipoise, mental quiescence. There's a lot of six-syllable words, I think. And what are the differences? You know, what are there? So I thought I would just give you, these are not debate definitions. They're not monastic textbook definitions. But I'll give you the general gist of each different concept, because there are many ideas, there are many words in Buddhism for meditation. Like in Russian, K. Merrick is good on that. It's like 20 words for foggy, dark, unpleasant, moody. I mean, there's all these words for dark, and, you know, I had to study it in college, and I didn't like the language. There's 100 words for dim, dark, foggy, you know, and Buddhism is different. Buddhism has 100 words for mind, 1,000 words for compassion, many different words for meditation. So it's good if you know the difference between those words. You'll hear them thrown around. People throw around samatha, samadhi, you know, and you don't know what they're talking about, and I'm afraid they don't know what they're talking about. So after you study it, you'll be able to tell. You'll study the actual differences between them. So I'll start you out on some of them. Gomba. If you have any inkling to learn a little, you can write it down. Some people in this class should be in the Tibetan class, but they don't want to fly. But I hope someday. Okay, the first word is Gomba. Say Gomba.
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 Gomba. Gomba is a word that comes from kom, which is a different word. And it means to get used to something, to habituate yourself to something. To get used to something. hum. This is ga. This is ka. You can't hear the difference. Same. I'll tell you, just to make it different for you. Let's say kumba. This is the word I want you to learn. This one here. Kumba.
What does it mean?
Verb. The verb is gomgya. To do kumba. This is the noun gomba. Meditation. This is one of the five or six words for meditation I'm going to teach you tonight.
What does kumba mean?
This is what kumba means. Kumba means to get used to something. By doing it over and over again. That's what kumba means. That's what the Tibetan word for meditation means.
Can we say habituation?
I like habituation. If you don't remember that long word, I don't mind if you say getting used to something, because that's what it is. The Sanskrit word is bhavana. You don't have to know that, but it's nice. You might see it in books. You know.
I think it's Sanskrit word for kumba.
Yeah, kumba. Meditating. This is the Sanskrit word. Okay, for this. This is Tibetan. This is Sanskrit. This is the Tibetan translation of this word.
Do we need to know the Sanskrit?
You don't need to know the Sanskrit. But I wanted you to know, we're going to get into samadhi, shamatha. People are using those in English now. So I thought I'll throw in the Sanskrit for this one, too. People aren't using bhavana.
There will
this
be
is
now.
The classic word. This is the real... this is the overall word in Tibetan for meditation. And if I ask you on homework, describe its general sense, you should say, bringing an object to your mind repeatedly until you get used to it. That's what it means. Mentally, you know, eyes closed, whatever, you are bringing an object to your mind until you get used to it. It's said in Tibetan Buddhist texts that you do this a lot at work with people you don't like. And you go home and you do bring them to mind. You make yourself miserable. You know, I said, God, I don't like that guy. You know, he bothered me again today. And that's kumba. You're bringing him to your mind. You're bringing his picture to your mind. You're bringing what he said to you to your mind, or what he didn't say to you, or whatever. And that's kumba. That is kumba. That is a kind of meditation. It means to bring an object to your mind repeatedly until it becomes burned into your mind. They have this thing in computers, screensavers, right? Why? The flying toasters. Because if the same image stays on the screen too long, it burns itself into the glass somehow. I don't know how.
It's backing on the inside of the screen.
That's meditation is exactly that. It really is that. You want to bring that image up so often that it burns itself into your consciousness. And that it comes back easily to your consciousness. That's gomba. So gomba means habituation, and it means to bring an object to mind repeatedly until it gets fixed in the mind. And that's one taste of meditation. That's one meaning of it. So the general sense is that bringing the object to your mind again and again until it's burned into your mind or fixed in your mind. That's the most general word in Tibetan for meditation. Yeah. This is another word in Tibetan, which is the root of this word. And this word literally means to get used to something. Like komsha means, I taught my puppy not to pee-pee on the floor. I have one nowadays in New Jersey, another one. And she's komba now to not pee-pee on the floor. That they'll say, that komsha. Now she's got used to it. She doesn't do it anymore. That's komsha. Or you can say, chibu yonin a komsha. He has become accustomed to coming late. Did somebody open the door?
No.
Okay. Maybe Mel doesn't know how to do it. Is there anybody in there?
No, he can do it.
Okay. Make sure he has the right key for the second door.
That's the first, second.
So this...
Something. Say something.
Something.
The Sanskrit word is dhyana. Something is the name of the fifth of the six perfections. There are six perfections. Whatever. Give me the first mini bag.
Generosity.
Giving.
Patient.
Morality.
Those Americans, morality. They don't need number two. Morality. Okay, giving, morality.
Patience.
Patience. Not getting angry. There is no English word for it, really. Number five. Four. Yeah. Effort.
Meditation.
Yeah, number five is meditation. Number six is wisdom. So this is the word for the fifth perfection, which is concentration or meditation. So see, you're going to get like five Tibetan words for the same thing. There are no English words for all these things. Samten means, first of all, it refers to the fifth perfection, which is meditation. Okay. The ability to concentration. Well, you'll learn what it is and you tell me.
Is dhyana like the five dhyani Buddhas?
They are called five dhyani Buddhas.
And does that mean five Buddhas in
meditation? Yeah, and why they're called that is a long story.
Okay.
Usually I say long story when I'm not too clear about it myself. They know that. Okay, Samten. I've seen it somewhere. I don't remember what it said. There is an explanation somewhere. It's not what it sounds like. There's some. I remember it's not.
Usually follow back and look it up in the computer.
Yeah.
That's
another one.
We'll get to
it. Fourth year, fifth class.
Okay. Samten. There are also four levels of meditation called Samten.
Is this a subdivision of this or something else?
Well, it is the fifth perfection, but the same word is used to describe four levels of very deep meditation. Those four levels of deep meditation, the result of those four kinds of meditation are to be reborn in one of the four levels of the form realm.
What?
Oh, I better go over this. There are three realms. We can only see one. There are two that we can't see. We are in the realm called desire realm. The first Dalai Lama in his commentary on the Abhidharma says, this is the desire realm because all we think about are food and sex. Okay. I mean, one of our main interests is these two things. And that's why this is called the desire realm. You've heard desire realm many times. Do a comment to that. We are in that realm.
That's the earth.
It's not... This earth is in that realm.
What else is?
Mount Meru and the top of Mount Meru, where there are certain deities that we can't see. Certain deities in the desire realm that we can't see. The Bardo people are in the desire realm. Hell people are in the desire realm. We can't see any of them. And Buddhism doesn't say you can see them. And Buddhism doesn't even say you should claim they exist until you can prove them pretty well, logically. So you don't have to believe in them right now. In fact, you shouldn't believe in them until you have some good proof. The next level up is called the form realm. We cannot see that realm. Form. Why is it called form realm? They have... It's a place where they have... They are very beautiful. They are all some kind of pleasure beings. They live in a state of high pleasure their whole life. They have beautiful bodies. They have bodies like a rainbow. And they live in pleasure their whole life. After that, they go to hell. That's another story.
The God realm?
It is part of the God realm extends to all three realms. The bottom of the God realm is in the desire realm. And then like that. But that's not the purpose of this class. Just to tell you that if you did those four kinds of something, which is the second meaning of something, what was the first meaning? The fifth perfection. Right? Which is a Buddhist perfection. But if you did just something, just this meditation, the result would be that you were to get born in one of those four realms, which we can't see. And I can't prove to you right now. If you're interested in the third realm, which I didn't get to, it's the formless realm. And those are mental beings. They have no bodies. They're purely mental beings. They have no physical bodies. That realm is not located anywhere because they are wherever they think. All right? You can be here and be in the... A formless realm being could be in this room if his mind is here. Because that's the way they are. Yeah.
You'd be reborn where?
Wherever your mind is.
No, in the four levels of the form.
Yeah, by doing the four kinds of something, those kinds of deep meditation, without any meaningful object, if it's just that you're hung up on those four, without any meaningful object, you will be born in one of those high deity realms. Can you guess why? What gets you into the high realms is great virtue, is great good deeds. Good deeds are defined as avoiding bad deeds. Why do you think a person who's doing something his whole life would be avoiding bad deeds? He's not moving. And it's famous, and there's a kind of morality called morality that's hooked to this. You can't do any verbal bad deeds because you can't talk and meditate at the same time. It's impossible. You can't do any physical bad deeds. You can't move and meditate at the same time. And you can't have any really bad mental bad deeds because your mind is single-pointedly fixed on a virtuous object. So they do have a great rebirth, but it doesn't last, and it's not desirable. But we'll get into that. Okay,
so
that's called dhyana.
Are you saying that's to be avoided then? Because, as you just said, you go to hell right afterwards? Or?
Well, that brings me to the next subject. If you want to see emptiness, although your body is in this desire realm, and although your basic mind state is a desire realm person's mind state, to see when you see emptiness, and you will see emptiness one day, directly, which is actually what stops all your suffering, the day that you see emptiness directly, your mind, your concentration is in the first samdhan. Your mind is not even in this realm. Your base mind is in this realm, but your concentration is actually on a higher level. And on that higher level, you have the ability to perceive emptiness.
Which realm would it be
then? The base mind, the supporting mental, the supporting brain, is in this realm. The body is in this realm. But the concentration is in a higher realm. So as you go into that meditation on emptiness for the first time, which if you can achieve it in this life is the greatest achievement you've ever... It's incredible. You feel a sense of going up to that realm mentally, and in that realm you see emptiness. And then you come down out of that realm. And then you see what?
Four noble truths.
You see the different parts of the four noble truths. This is the process. So your mind goes up to that level, the first samdhan. You see emptiness based on that level, and then you come down. Your mind comes down. You're sitting there, but you're not aware of your body. Okay. All right. So that's the general sense of samdhan. So if I ask you, there, you should really say three kinds of samdhan, three meanings of samdhan. The first one is as the fifth perfection of the six Buddhist perfections. The second meaning is as that kind of meditation, which if it's all you do, you'll be reborn into the form realm as a deity. Yeah, F-O-R-M. So-called because they have beautiful bodies. And if you're... The third sense of samdhan is the important one. On the first samdhan level, with your mind in that level, you can see emptiness directly. Seeing emptiness directly functions to stop your suffering permanently. You no longer will need to get old, etc.
So really the third definition is a clarification of the second one?
They're all something. But I'm just giving you the important places where they come in Buddhist scripture.
And right. Some people bypass the seeing of emptiness while experiencing these four levels.
Yeah, you can waste, if you're concentrating on a picture of Vishnu or something, mentally, you can reach a something. And
even maybe the second something, say, bypassing experiencing emptiness.
Yeah, no, right, you would not perceive emptiness.
Can you say what the four noble truths are?
Yeah, first one is, well, you tell, still well. They studied it. It was on their test. I hope to God they remember it.
Yeah. The first noble truth is that life is dissatisfactory.
Yeah, it's suffering.
And the second is that it has a cause.
Yeah, the suffering has a cause.
and that there's an end to suffering and that it has a cause.
Which is the path. So that's the four. So the first one is suffering. Second one is the end of suffering. Third one is the end of suffering. And the fourth one is the path that leads to that end.
Second one is
where the suffering comes from.
Cause.
The cause of suffering. Which is mainly your bad emotions. Hatred, jealousy, desire, anger. And our other close friends. Okay. Yeah, sure.
You said, and that's Diana.
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 What part? Diana.
I heard everything else you said. I wrote it all down, but.
Well, the Sanskrit word is Diana.
Okay. Sanskrit.
Yeah, I'm trying to give you the Sanskrit words because you will hear them. Okay. You've heard Dhyani Buddhas. You've heard Shamatha practice. You've heard Samadhi. I just want you to, you know, somebody says, what's shamatha? And what's the difference between shamatha and samadhi? You say, oh, I studied that.
So dhyana is a Sanskrit word for self.
Something, yeah.
Okay.
Or you should say Tibetan word for that. It's a translation. Yeah.
Could you also clarify again the three formless realms?
There's three realms. There's three realms of suffering beings. Okay. By the way, the Buddhists don't live in these three realms. These are the three realms of suffering beings. One realm you can see, it's the desire world. That's where we live. That's this world that you know. You've never seen the other two realms. They are stated in scripture. After you see emptiness directly, you will understand that those realms do really exist. You will experience them. Until that time, you can say, the Buddha said they exist. I've studied them in many authoritative scriptures. I can't tell you for sure if they exist. I haven't perceived them directly. The second realm is the form realm. You can't see it. And the third realm is the formless realm, and you never will see it because there's no physical matter in that realm. It's a mental realm. And the beings there have no bodies. They're purely mental. Nyamjuk. Nyamjuk has three basic meanings. The Sanskrit word is not very common. You probably haven't seen it. And you don't need to know this. I'm just giving it to people who might want to. When their friends ask them what's shamatha, they'll say, oh, I know that. It's called sammapatti.
This is the word for shamatha?
No. This is the word for sammapatti. We got two more to go. Three more to go. By the way, in English, what do you use? You know, these translators pull their hair out. That's why I got this. Nyamjuk. Okay. Nyamjuk. You can think there are three basic kinds. Okay? This is a kind of meditative state, okay? The first one is a meditation which is going to end you into the... it's going to make you reborn into the form realm. So in that sense, it's very similar to samatha. It's meditation which, if that's all you do, and Hindus, you know, saints do it, they just meditate on this kind of meditation. It's very high, it's a virtue. It's a goodness. It's a good deed. Mainly because you can't do any bad things if you're concentrating so strongly. You will be reborn in the form realm. That's one kind of yoga.
So this is like your boss?
Yeah, I think so. Mostly. If he never did bad deeds to get his money.
Yeah.
But in the moments that he's concentrating on money, yeah, it's neutral. You know, he's not really hurting him. So that's, by the way, I don't really know who God knows. I don't know anyone's mind. He could be a Buddha. Sometimes I think he is. You know, we don't know. We have to be careful. I just use him as an example. Okay? I could use myself, but it's boring. Okay, form realm. The second kind is Nyamjuk, which lands you in the formless realm. Okay. These two kinds of Nyamjuk we call causal Nyamjuk, because they are kinds of meditation which cause you to be reborn in one of those two realms.
Second one, I'm sorry, the formless
realm, where you don't have any body. Mm-hmm. You're a purely mental being, and you're in an intense state of happiness. Some people mistake that for paradise. You see? It's a very dangerous thing. Some people mistake, and even the meditation is so pleasant that it's very attractive. And they mistake that result for what you would call heaven or paradise. It's not a permanent heaven. It's not a desirable thing. There's better ones.
Is it the same as samadhi?
No, it's not it.
It's
okay.
Not it.
So there's lots, okay?
Yeah.
That's why I'm going through this.
Is there a particular object?
They can pick objects like the typical objects in Hinduism are you know, Shiva's form or Vishnu's form or Indra's form or things like that. But the basic thing is that you don't create any bad deeds while you're doing it. No verbal, physical, or mental bad deeds.
Why are they in bliss when they're doing this meditation?
One side effect of meditation, and not the object of meditation, not the goal of meditation, is called Shinjan. And Shinjan means very, very pleasant physical sensations and very, very pleasant mental sensations, which at some points are a distraction.
What causes it?
They're not desirable. You could explain it in the higher teachings, which I can't get into.
In the posture?
We talked about it at the end of the last class, in the last class, if you remember. I have to distinguish between the common path and the uncommon path. Right?
Right.
Okay, but that, it's related to that. And that's why that practice involves a lot of this.
Namjok is related to the
Shinjan? No. So far we have two kinds of Namjok. One is a kind of meditation that if you do it and you don't do anything better, you end up being born in the form of it. According to Buddhist scripture, I can't prove it to you. I can't even prove to you that it exists. And that's part of Buddhism. We have to admit what we can't see. The second kind of Namjok is the one that makes you born in the formless realm. The third kind of Nyamjut is called cessation meditation. Cessation meditation. And this is a state in which you can put yourself where your mind is almost shut down. And in some schools, it was believed that that was nirvana. That was the end of suffering. And we'll discuss it. It's not really. Your mind is still going on at a very, very subtle level. But the gross mind is almost shut down. And you can stay that way for a long, long, long time.
So when you say your mind, you're talking about...
52 functions of your mind, which we'll study later. Mainly sensation and discrimination. The ability to feel things and the ability to discriminate between different objects. Those are shut down to such a subtle level that it's close to nirvana. It is not nirvana. But it was taken to be nirvana, and it's called cessation meditation.
That's feeling and perception?
It actually shuts down all your mental processes to a very, very, very subtle level. But mainly those two. That's the big deal, because those are the two mental functions out of the 52 which get you in trouble. Okay. You like your friends, you don't like your enemies. You like what feels good, you don't like what feels good.
Sensation more?
Sensation and discrimination. The ability to say, I like this person, I don't like this one. He's my friend, he's my enemy. This is warm, this is cold. Yeah.
Are you saying that this was mistaken for nirvana because it resembles nirvana, or because the people who mistook it for nirvana didn't understand nirvana and it doesn't resemble nirvana? Mainly, if you're not discriminating and you don't have sensation, that's attributes of nirvana?
No, but there are Buddhist schools, which we talked about when we studied nirvana last time, which believe that when you achieve nirvana, your mind and your body are actually discontinued. The word is discontinued. That's not wrong. That's not what the actual truth is. That's not what nirvana is. What is nirvana? Hey, Jiva. Definition of nirvana. Remember? How are you going to get there if you don't know what it is? No. Stopping what? Stopping?
Mental affliction.
Yeah. What was the rest of it?
In their entirety.
comes from the individual now.
Yeah. Okay. It's stopping your bad thoughts, all of them, permanently, because you saw emptiness directly.
Because what?
Through seeing emptiness directly. As a result of seeing emptiness directly. That's the definition of nirvana. So you can achieve nirvana this evening. You look the same to me. You look the same to everybody else. You don't disappear. You know, there is another kind of nirvana, right? Where you do this. I mean, you get rid of the suffering body. But that's another story. Basically, nirvana means removing permanently your bad emotions, which would mean you'd never suffer again. So they mistook that for that. Yeah. There were schools of Buddhism that said nirvana was the discontinuation of your body and mind, which is not the case. There were lower schools that taught that. And that's what most Western people think when they hear nirvana.
So the earlier two were causal meditation because they cause rebirth in those two realms.
And the third is a kind of deep, 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 deep meditation.
It's a cessation meditation, but does
it's
it cause...
It's cessation, but it's not the truth of cessation.
You still have a rebirth. It still causes a rebirth.
Yeah, so it's not a real cessation.
It's still a causal meditation.
It's a cause of intent, but it's not a cause of...
Not the same cause,
Those are the ideas, the three ideas of Nyonju.
Is there a rebirth associated with this meditation or no?
You would be reborn if that's all you did. It's not a, it doesn't get you to nirvana. It's not nirvana. It's not even cessation. It's concentration. Okay. We got two more, then we'll take a break.
But there's nothing associated with that, like the others that you call causal. Is that what you just answered for me?
I said there were three kinds of Nyonju.
Yeah.
The first two we call causal, because they're called a high rebirth. The third one has nothing to do with the first two. The third one is a cessation Nyonju. It's a Buddhist practice. You get so deep into meditation that your mind is almost shut down. It's not a... It's mostly lower school. It's mostly Hinayana, Abhidharma. It's not a desirable. In fact, in some scriptures it's described as a distraction.
Cessation meditation?
Yeah, because it's not cessation. It's just it's such a deep state of meditation. Supposedly you can stay in it for hundreds of years.
So you're telling us about all these different types of meditation, but these are not necessarily the ones we're going to
be. No, we'll get to the real ones. But these are things you will hear about, and you should know about them. And I want you to get a flavor for what meditation, how deep it is. I mean, there's so many kinds. So many. The Abhidharma has hundreds of pages of what goes on. They have an analysis of what kinds of thoughts can follow what kinds of other thoughts. Every variation, every permutation, it takes page after page after page. If you're translating it, you get dizzy. You can have a virtuous thought after this bad thought, unless you're thinking this other thought. But what can follow that thought? You know, this is Shine. The Sanskrit word is Shamatha. You always see this in relation, linked with this.
Is that the Sanskrit?
Yeah, I'll check my computer. It looks wrong. I don't think there's two pieces, but I'll check it for you. You almost always see shamatha connected with vipassana. In Thailand, it's called vipassana or something. Vipassana. That's more from the Pali. So they're all related, same thing.
And they also use
bhavana. Bhavana, yeah. Oh, yeah? Good. Okay. So if you want to get the flavor for this word for meditation, think of it in terms of a union between shamatha and vipassana. These two are always married. Shine and Hakdo, Tibetan.
In a sense, if you're doing that kind of meditation, you also are doing...
We'll talk about it. Shamatha is the very, very most... It's the highest evolution of meditation. The most powerful state of meditation. The highest evolution of meditation. The highest form of meditation. There's many kinds of Gomba or Samten, Nyomju, but Shine is number one. Okay, Shine is really when you get very, very, very good. This is Shine. This is Shamatha. It's a very, very powerful state of meditation, which is linked with Vipassana, which means the perception of emptiness, wisdom. Okay? Paktong, which means exceptional insight. Pak means exceptional. Tong means seeing. It's focused on emptiness. It's a very high form of knowledge, which is seeing emptiness.
So this is not Vipassana meditation?
It is.
It is.
Well, that's a misnomer, see? And you'll have to study it.
Yeah, I'm confused about that.
We'll have to study it. That's why it's called Paktong. And we will study this. But you always see these two linked together. Okay? When you hear Shamatha, you should think Vipassana. Because they are linked together. The goal, one of the highest goals is to have them linked together, is to have this incredibly powerful instrument focused on emptiness, wisdom.
And that's all it means.
Wisdom and beauty, yeah. I'll give you a definition sometime. Basically, this is what you're aiming for. This is the goal of your meditation. You want to reach Shamatha. In and of itself, it's not such a big deal. You want it to be imbued with Vipassana. You want to have wisdom that has this powerful ability to concentrate on emptiness. And that's what Shamatha is. In its highest form. Right, there are many other forms, but this is the one you're shooting for. Basically, these are the fifth and sixth perfections at their highest level. Fifth and sixth.
Perfections.
Meditation and wisdom. Those are the two highest forms of those two perfections. When you reach the two last perfections, that's what they will be.
So when you said the perfection of the perfection of...
Perfection is a difficult word. It doesn't mean the ultimate form of that thing. It means something else. It's Parotachimba. You've had Shiragi Parotachimba. You know what it means. What is the perfection of wisdom? Does it mean the Buddha's wisdom? Does it mean the ultimate evolution of wisdom? What is the definition of perfection?
It's understanding emptiness joined with love or bodhicitta.
Yeah, yeah. Under the influence of compassion, this is the perfection of wisdom. It can happen long before you become a Buddha. So perfection doesn't mean... Perfection is an attempt to translate the Sanskrit word paramita. It's the Tibetan word paramita, which means to go beyond, to reach the farthest end. But it's a difficult translation. It doesn't mean the final evolution, because it's not omniscient. You can have the perfection of wisdom long before you reach the Buddha's mind state. All right. Last one before you get done. Samadhi, very famous, right? Very famous word. The definition, the broad definition, and I'm not giving you precise definitions, probably because I don't know them by heart, is Sechipa, Sem Sechipa, which means one pointed mind, one pointed state of mind. I'm going to tell you what one-pointed means, because I wondered about it for years.
Pointed?
Okay, one-pointed state of mind. And I finally found these classical references. One-pointed means one object. The meaning, when they say in Buddhism, one-pointed state of mind, is one object. You're able to keep your mind on one object. Tightly. Strong. That's Tingenzin. That's the definition of samadhi. It's just the ability to keep the mind on one object.
But how does that differ from Shamatha?
We'll talk about it.
Shmata is the king.
Are you going to give us a Sanskrit for that?
Yeah, it's Samadhi.
Oh.
Samadhi. D means mind, Sama means equal. But we definitely do that. The Tibetan word is difficult to translate. Dinge means. Like, Lo Ting Ting means vivid green. It's a green which is pulsating, or. It's a very rare, it's a very special word in Tibetan. Mm-hmm. When you're driving in Switzerland and you look over and there's one of these Swiss meadows with this incredible, vibrant green, this is called Lo Ting Ye. Mm-hmm. So Tingye means like this incredible, vibrant color usually. And Zin means to hold. So all these Tibetan words are very difficult to translate. Samten, they don't, you know, translators who don't know Tibetan very well struggle with the meanings of the units of the word. But they don't have any, they have a nice flavor, but they don't describe one point of mind. You see what I mean? So don't get too hung up on the meaning of the words themselves. You'll get lost. They don't have much to do with what the thing is. Okay. They came from the old tradition of translation, like Khön Chok, which in ancient Tibet, in which they translated the feeling of the word and not the meaning of the word. and most of those translations were later banned. Some of them have survived. So, Tingenzin, Samadhi. Samadhi means the ability to keep the mind one-pointed. So what's the difference between Samadhi and Shamatha? Shamatha is the highest evolution of this. You can have Tingenzin at work. You know, you can have especially Tingenzin watching a movie or reading a good book. And you start to slobber. I mean, if you've ever reached that, if you play music, for example, if you really get into it, you know, you find yourself, you're so into it that you're drooling and you don't know it because you're not thinking to close your mouth. That's Tingenzin. And you can have it, everyone gets it. Every mind has Tingenzin. Tingenzin is a state of mind that every mind has. It's just either developed or not developed. A bug has Tingenzin. Tingenzin is one of the states of mind that accompanies all other states of mind. Every being who's conscious has some ability to concentrate.
The idea is it's only for a split second, perhaps.
Yeah.
Whereas in the Shine, you can do it for.
Yeah, Shine is the you know, the highest evolution of this innate ability to concentrate. So everyone has Tingenzin. Everyone has some part of Samadhi. That's stated in the Abhidhamma Kosha. It's one of the 10 states of. It's one of the 10 mental functions that every conscious being has all the time. Yeah.
So what is the difference between Samadhi and Samatha?
Yeah, Samadhi is just your ability to concentrate that you already have. Shamatha is when you practice until you're able to keep your mind in deep meditation, so deep that it goes to a higher realm and you see emptiness.
So it's like more
powerful. It's that simple. It's one of the 10 mental functions that every conscious being has all the time. Yeah.
So what is the difference between Samadhi and Samatha?
Yeah, Samadhi is just your ability to concentrate that you already have. Shamatha is when you practice until you're able to keep your mind in deep meditation, so deep that it goes to a higher realm and you see emptiness.
So it's like more powerful.
It's that ability to concentrate is the samadhi which you have taken to its highest level through practicing. And you can do it because your mind is plastic. Your mind is moldable. Of all things in the world, your mind, if you expose it to the wrong things, it's going to be coming out a month from now. Don't worry. It must. It will. Your mind is very influenceable. Your mind is like silly putty. You have to be very careful what you expose it to. But on the good side, if you, you know, expose it to a good object repeatedly, which is what? Gong. It must come out a good result later. You know, that's why it's proven result later. You know, that's why it's proven in the Pramanavartika, Dharmakirti's classic work, that you can reach the ultimate state of compassion. because your mind is influenceable. Your mind is fluid. If you keep exposing it to a holy object, it must become holy. And if you keep exposing it to TV, well, what do you expect? No, your mind is like a mirror, and whatever you put in that mirror, whatever appears in that mirror often enough, the mind must become that nature. So your mind is very—it's very dangerous. You don't want to expose it to things which are not nice.
Yeah. So is that why they say when you say you're doing a calm abiding meditation on your breath, for example, mm-hmm. versus calm abiding meditation with the object of concentration as the Buddha, mm-hmm. that it's more virtuous to concentrate on the Buddha because by concentrating on the Buddha, your mind becomes yeah. holy? Extra virtue
yeah.
they talk about?
Oh, yeah.
Is that it?
There's a kind of samadhi it's you can extra. Do. There's a famous example in India of a man who stayed in a cave and he meditated that he had horns. You know, bull's horns. And he did so good that when he tried to get out of the cave, he kept hitting his horns on the side. He couldn't get out. You know, mentally, he couldn't get out. And he couldn't get out of the entrance of the cave. And they say, you know, great in the sense of meditating, useless in the sense of the object. You know, why didn't you pick a better object to habituate your mind to? That's a classic example. Yeah.
You just said calm abiding meditation, which we do
I'm
a
not
lot.
Gonna,
which one
I'm
was
not
going to
touch
this?
All these English translations. I give up. Calm abiding is a translation of shine, which is shambhatara. And shi means peace and ne means to stay. It does not mean to put your mind in a nice, pleasant, buzzed out state. And that's why you got to be careful about that. Sham does mean peace, but it's a particular kind of peace. I would prefer that you think of shamatha as a powerful gun than as a cotton candy, you know. It's a very powerful weapon aimed at the right object. It's not like, hey, man, you know. And I'm afraid that the word is, you see, it's one of those old translations. It kind of tends to intimate that it's just a pleasant, peaceful, calm abiding. No, if anything, it's a fierce experience. It's a very powerful telescope aimed at a very holy object, and the result is an atom bomb. You know, it's a different kind of thing. Okay, have some tea. And there's some soup. If you didn't get any dinner before you came, you're welcome to have some soup. Well, we'll start in 10 minutes. I'm just going to give you the names of the six preliminary practices that you do before meditation. And then I'll explain them next week. But in the meantime, I'd like to memorize them. Not in Tibetan, just in English. Chakshal is number one. Chakshal means frustration. Bowing down. I remember the first time I had to do it, I didn't want to do it, I didn't like to do it. I was brought up as a Christian, and in the Christian religion, one of the things says you will not bow down before the grave, and I felt uncomfortable. I didn't do it for a while. And I don't regret that I didn't do it for a while, because I didn't know what it meant, and it didn't feel comfortable to me. Sel means to look for something. Chak means the hand. It's the honorific word for hand. It's used for a high lama's hand. And it means to look for something from the hand of somebody. To look for a gift from his hand. So it means really that you are showing your respect. And we'll go through the whole thing. It has a lot more meaning than just getting down on the floor. If it's not comfortable for you, don't worry about it. We can't do it in here anyway.
One at a time.
Yeah.
Is it good for your lower back?
It has a lot of... We'll talk about it. But I'll tell you this. When you perceive emptiness directly, when you come out of that, you'll understand the meaning of prostration for the first time. And you'll get down and you'll bow because you saw something incredible. You saw something that deserves a bow.
Can you just tell us about it for now?
And it'll be a natural reaction to what you saw. And you'll get up and start prostrating. And at that moment, you'll know what it is. And I think before that, you never really know what it is. You want to get down on your knees in front of that thing. And that's just something that we'll talk about. Chöpa means offering. This is a mistake. I mixed up. The homework says don't mix up the 7 and the 6. I did. Scratch the first one. Sorry.
I ran out of paper.
I learned one thing.
Can I have a piece?
You know that the homework says don't confuse the 6 and the 7.
So you're just testing us to see if we knew the difference, and we failed, huh? Isn't it?
Yeah, right.
Is that one the 7?
It's one of the 7, but you're not going to do the 7 tonight. I just want you to know the 6.
And what is this, the 1 and the 2 of?
The 6 things that you have to do before you start meditating. And I messed up. Okay. I'm making it simple. It's a long sentence, but I'm just... Nikon Sama means that you get up and you tidy up the room. You make the room clean. I do not mean nothing good this. But it's actually, we'll talk about it, but it's very important actually. So when you get up in the morning and you're ready to start your meditation, the first thing is to tidy up everything. You make your bed, sweep the floor. In the monastery, you know, 5 o'clock, you see all these monks out with these little brooms doing the floor of their house. It's already spotless, but this is part of the meditation. And it has a specific purpose, and we'll talk about it. It actually gets you ready for meditation, physically even. So that's cleaning up your room, sweeping it, making everything nice, tidy.
Where do you meditate only, not the whole house?
I don't want to study.
I clean up the whole house.
Yeah, that could be a distraction. Chepa is offering. Offering is a short word. But actually, you set up an altar, and you put out certain images and things like that, and then you put out some pretty offerings. And we'll talk about that. Which one was it? Which one did you mean?
Chepa.
You already write it, didn't you, in Tibetan? No.
Yeah.
Did you miss it? Jabdo means going for refuge. If you were in the last class, you did it. You know it well. And Semke, which is trying to develop the wish to become a Buddha so that you can help. It's the wish to become perfect so that you can help all beings. It's the wish to achieve your own paradise so that you can really help other people. That's sort of a pleasant task. You know, it's not as nasty. It's achieve everything you ever wanted to help other people. That's okay.
First part's pretty good.
That's
yeah.
All right. And implied here, and you should write it in your homework, implied here is that you take the proper posture before you do that. So you're...
Meditation posture.
Yeah. You're sitting down the right kind of seat, and you're placing yourself on that seat in the proper position, and then you try to think these two things. So I didn't write out the whole thing because I didn't want to overwhelm
you. You try to think two things?
These two, taking refuge and bodhicitta. Oh. And that's expressed in the prayer that we do every class, before every class. You have that in your notebook. It has the same title at the top, Kyabdo
Sangha. What was that word you said, bodhicitta?
Bodhicitta, which means Buddha mind, bodhi mind, which does not refer, which the other students all know because they studied the definition. We did the whole thing. All right. Definition of it. Basically, the wish to achieve paradise yourself so that you can help others. So you can really be a Samatha, because when you do that, you become omniscient. You know all the problems they're ever going to face in the next 50 years, and then you can really help them. Kyamna Senke. Okay, talk to me. Nikpa means to visualize. Tsokshi means a big picture with all the lamas in it. All the lamas who have passed down the great two lineages since the beginning of Buddhism in this planet. What are the two lineages? Emptiness and compassion. So you're visualizing the major lamas who have passed this down to us. And we'll talk about it. To put it simply, that's put very simply.
To visualize all the Buddhas in the lineage. That's what you mean.
Of the two great lineages, which is emptiness and compassion. They've come down through different lineages. I mean, the major. Every Lama had both. There were many main teachers of Buddha. Dip, you know, right? Nyun dip, she dip, you remember? You didn't have that. Dip means obstacle. Spiritual obstacle. Two different kinds. Friend? Come on.
What's your question?
Two kinds of obstacles. Remember?
Obstacles to omniscience?
That's the second one.
And bad thoughts?
Yeah, and bad thought obstacles. One describes the kind of obstacle. One describes what it's obstacling. Okay? The first one, which is bad thought obstacles, are what prevent you from reaching nirvana. Things like anger. The second kind, which are obstacles to reaching omniscience, prevent you from becoming a Buddha. They prevent you from knowing all things. Subtle kinds of ignorance. Jhana means to purify those obstacles, to clean yourself of those obstacles.
This is the end of Class 1.